Hi, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Black Girls Have Anxiety 2, the safe space created for Black women by Black women to strip away the taboo of talking about mental health. You'll hear from mental health professionals and advocates, as well as Black women sharing their experiences as we break down the complexities, explore ways to heal, and support each other. My name is Ashley. I'm your host. Whether you're a seasoned regular or this is your first time tuning in, thank you so much for your support. Now let's get into today's episode. Back to another episode of Black Girls Have Anxiety 2. I'm your host, Ashley Nas. Thank you so much for joining me again. If it's your first time here, welcome. I am just excited to bring you all some really cool information today. I've been doing a ton of research and I wanted to do something special for Black History Month. If you've been listening to the podcast, you know I don't really follow the themes throughout the year too much. I kind of just record and try to let the conversations come out at its own pace. But this year, it's been on my mind, on my heart to really do something special for Black History Month in terms of highlighting the trailblazers, the Black trailblazers that are in the mental health field. I know Black people only take up about 2% of mental health professionals at this moment in time. So I've just been curious around, like, who are some of the lesser known people within mental health that have had a huge impact on mental health. So I'm going to bring you a couple of really interesting people today. Maybe you've heard of them, maybe you haven't. But before we jump in, I just want to take a moment to do a quick check-in. Y'all know with these episodes where it's just me and I don't have a guest, I like to do a quick check-in to see how everybody's doing. How do you feel about your mental health right now in this moment? How are you feeling today? How are you feeling this week on a scale of 1 to 10? How mentally healthy do you feel? I have to say today, as far as my mental health, I feel really good. So I am just being present in the fact that I feel good today. My anxiety is not high. Thank God. I just feel happy, healthy, and I am just being present in this particular moment. Just a couple things that I have been doing that have been helping my mental health, in particular helping my anxiety, are breathing exercises. And I keep talking about this, but it's because it's working. It's helping me a lot. I've been doing pranayama breathing. And I also have been doing diaphragmatic breathing. Now the diaphragmatic breathing, I'm just doing like 5 minute videos that I find on YouTube. That's where I get the majority of my like meditations and breathing exercises, just because it's really easy to get up, do it in the morning, or I have a playlist, like a breathe playlist, and I can, you know, at my lunch break, just do a 5 or 10 minute breathing exercise. So that's been really helpful for me. But it also is helping me be conscious of how I'm breathing and if I'm taking deeper breaths or if I'm taking like the short anxious breaths where it's just in your chest. So that's been helping me. One other thing that has been helping me is just having a moment of gratitude every morning. And so like before my feet hit the ground, I like to thank God about for 5 different things. And so I try to come up with 5 new things every day, but sometimes I just kind of like go with what comes first. So I think for me, when you're living with anxiety, especially when it's disordered anxiety, a lot of it is like seeped in worry. And so being able to have that moment of gratitude, where you're naming 5 things, kind of starts your day. On the other side of that, where it's not worry, but it is thankfulness for what you have. So, I just want everybody to think about like, what are 5 things that you're thankful for right now in this moment? I'll let you guys think about that. And I want to jump in. And like I mentioned earlier, I wanted to put a spotlight on Black people that have had an impact on mental health. And I'm calling them change makers because ultimately, like, that's what they are. Trailblazers, change makers, pioneers, however you want to title it. I'm highlighting people whose like passion and dedication and resilience have been catalysts for the evolution of some aspect of mental health as a whole. So the first person that I want to introduce to you all today is Dr. Solomon Carter Fuller. Now, full transparency, as I have been doing research for these episodes, I have learned a lot myself. And so Dr. Solomon Carter Fuller, he is known as the first Black psychiatrist in the United States. He's made significant, y'all know I gotta clear my throat sometimes. Dr. Fuller has made significant contributions to the study, particularly of Alzheimer's disease. He worked directly alongside, he was involved and steeped in the process of actually doing the initial research when it comes to Alzheimer's with Alois Alzheimer. I don't know if I'm pronouncing his name correctly. Alois. But let's get back to Dr. Fuller. So Dr. Solomon Carter Fuller was born in Monrovia, Liberia in 1872. He was actually the grandson of American slaves who purchased, or American enslaved people, who purchased their freedom and left for Liberia under the American Colonization Fund, which I had never heard of until looking at this information. Dr. Fuller came to the U.S. when he was around 17 years old to study medicine with the intention of returning to Liberia to become a medical missionary like his maternal grandparents. I just want to pause real quick because he was 17, leaving Liberia and coming to the States in, what was this, 1895. My math is not mathing right now. But 1890s, as a Black man to study medicine, I think that in itself is like, that makes you a trailblazer, that alone. But he went on to receive his full medical degree from Boston University School of Medicine. He completed a 2-year internship at Westboro State Hospital in Massachusetts, and then followed up with that with beginning his professional duties as a hospital pathologist and an instructor of pathology at Boston University. In his early years, he was performing autopsies to collect and analyze tissue sections from deceased mental patients. And through that, he was making discoveries that ultimately advanced his career. But I want to go back to earlier in his career. He was actually he traveled to Europe to become one of only 5 research assistants that were hand-selected by a Jewish doctor in Germany, in Munich, Germany, named Alois Alzheimer, to work in his lab at the Royal Psychiatric Hospital in Munich, Germany. So they were studying pre-senile dementia. In this particular experience, these 5 research assistants and Dr. Alzheimer really started the research that paved the way when it comes to research for Alzheimer's disease. So Dr. Fuller not only aided in the research, but he was actually the first to translate Dr. Alzheimer's work into English and German. And that included the first ever reported case of the disease, and it was the report was based on a particular individual called Auguste Dieter. Hopefully I'm pronouncing that right. If I'm not, give me some grace. Dr. Fuller also published what is now recognized to be the first comprehensive review of Alzheimer's disease, and in it he reports about the 9th case of Alzheimer's ever described. So this man was really doing the most right now, like in all the best ways. I want to go back just really quickly to Dr. Alois Alzheimer. So just so you understand the impact of and the gravity of him going to Europe to work for this particular doctor in Germany, I'm going to give you a little bit of background on Dr. Alzheimer's, who Alzheimer's was named after. So Dr. Alois Alzheimer, he was actually born Aloysius in 1864. He was invited to open up a psychiatric clinic in Munich as a research assistant alongside another doctor by the name of Emil Krepelin. I don't know where the accent came from when I said that, but it sounded like it was right, Krepelin. In 1906, Dr. Alzheimer gave a notoriously famous talk to the 37th Congress of Psychiatrists of Southern Germany. In that particular talk, he stated that he had identified an unusual disease of the cerebral cortex. For those of y'all that aren't like science nerds like me, that is a part of your brain. In the unusual disease of the cerebral cortex, he found that it had affected a woman by the name of Auguste Dieter, who was the woman I mentioned earlier. But this disease had caused symptoms of memory loss, disorientation, and hallucinations that occurred all the way up to Auguste Dieter's death at 50 years of age. So very young. And so they found it to be atypical, abnormal, like odd case, right? In 1910, Krepelin named the disease as Alzheimer's disease in the 8th edition of the Handbook of Psychiatry. Going back to Auguste Dieter, so in the postmortem autopsy, when she passed at the age of 50, they found that the cerebral cortex was thinner than normal and had senile plaque that was usually only seen in elderly people. And they also found neurofibrillary tangles. So these were very pivotal and this was huge in terms of getting a better understanding of why these symptoms were occurring and actually putting a name to it. And Dr. Solomon Carter Fuller was a pivotal part of that journey. I want to go and share a little bit of his paper that he, the paper that he translated and that was spread around the world in English to other people, other mental health professionals, psychiatrists, all of those people. But I'm going to share a little bit from that particular paper on a particular case. So this case was on a man who's 56 years of age, and it says for some time previous to his final breakdown, about 2 years prior, had shown a memory defect, short periods of apparent unconsciousness or dreamlike states, verbal amnesia, and occasional paraphasia, which I believe is when you're not able to speak. Don't quote me on it. But had been able to continue at work as a laborer on a farm where he had been employed for many years. His sister states that the memory defect had been gradual, and while at first the short periods of confusion that consisted of a few minutes in duration, in which he spoke in paraphasic or senseless manner, were only seldom observed, of late these had become very frequent. Recently, even when there was no apparent mental confusion, he often seemed unable to provide the proper word or words to employ in ordinary conversation. He would often search for familiar objects incorrectly. That's known as apraxia. And within the last 6 months, when he had visited his sister's home, he would relate to her over and over again about the same experience within the course of a few minutes, apparently forgetting that he had already done so. Upon going to bed, he would make several separate bundles of his clothing, placing one here, another there, all over the place. And in the morning, he couldn't remember what he did with his clothing. Another interesting thing that popped up in here is that 20 years prior to the onset of Alzheimer's, he had separated from his wife on account of her infidelity. It says this affair had worried him quite a little, but he never formally spoke of it to anyone. And once the symptoms started, it mentions that of late, however, he constantly referred to his wife in conversation and wondered where she was and whether he had done the proper thing in leaving her. It also says, as a result, he was slightly depressed. So this is quite a detailed account of this particular individual, but this is a huge paper that Dr. Fuller again, was pivotal in making sure it got to the masses so people understood more about the disease. After his stint with Dr. Alzheimer's, he returned to Westboro State Hospital. He then spent much of his career at Boston University School of Medicine. In his later years, he recruited, staffed, and trained Black psychiatrists at the Tuskegee Veterans Hospital. He also trained medical staff to diagnose side effects of syphilis. This was very intentional because what he was trying to do is to prevent Black war veterans from getting misdiagnosed, discharged, and ultimately being deemed ineligible for military benefits because of having syphilis. So not only was he like going overseas and making all this change, but he came back and just immediately started helping the community. Dr. Fuller eventually met his wife, and her name is Meta Vo Warwick. She was an influential and accomplished sculptor, and they met in 1909. Right now, today, her art collections can actually be found in an art museum called Danforth Art Museum in Massachusetts and at the Smithsonian. So talk about a power couple, like major change makers, right? Now, we all know that as great as these accomplishments are, the reality is that Dr. Solomon Fuller was still a Black man in America, regardless of his accomplishments, regardless of his education. The reality is, when you're walking down the street, he was still a Black man in America. They were still a Black family in America, and there were some familiar struggles that came with that. One of which was after him and Meta and their family, they had three sons, I believe. They settled in Massachusetts since he was working at Boston University School of Medicine. There was actually a petition by his neighbors who were white to have them removed from their home and from their neighborhood. Like somebody took time out of their day for this man who was like saving lives. Not that that should warrant people leaving you alone, but my goodness, they're trying to kick them out simply for the color of his skin, and trying to kick them literally out of their home. It didn't work. They failed at that. They were able to stay in their home, but even though they were able to stay in their home and he continued to work at Boston University School of Medicine, he was still quite underpaid and underemployed compared to his white colleagues. So it was, as many achievements that he had, he was still underrepresented, like most Black physicians were. And I think that his accomplishments and his contributions warrant recognition, which is why I'm bringing it up on the pod today. So even to this day, Dr. Fuller's legacy continues. His portrait is actually hanging at the American Psychiatric Association headquarters in Washington, D.C. And in 1969, the APA, or the American Psychiatric Association, established the Solomon Carter Fuller Award. And that was specifically created to honor Black pioneers who have significantly improved the quality of life for Black people. So amazing things that this man has done, from like scientific papers and publications to like research on neuropathology and the biological basis of psychiatric disorders, and his work on dementia, memory loss, Alzheimer's, major contributions. And I hope that if you didn't know him before, we know him now, and I hope that we continue to bring light to his legacy. So share his story, ask somebody if they know who he is, and, you know, spread the word. Wow, what a story, right? So I've got one more for you guys today. And shifting gears from a mental health professional that had a huge impact on the world of mental health, I'm shifting gears to somebody who, I don't want to call them a layperson, but we're just going to say a non-mental health professional, right? Y'all know on this podcast, I highlight people that are mental health professionals. They've got all the letters behind their name. They've got all the degrees. But I also highlight people that I call mental health adjacent. And to me, that just means maybe they don't have, they're not clinicians, they're not mental health professionals, but they are still advocates for mental health. So I would like to introduce you all to Bebe Moore Campbell. So Bebe Moore Campbell is a Black author, journalist, teacher, and was a mental advocate for, mental health advocate for people from marginalized communities. When she was growing up in California, she left and was a student and an activist at the University of Pittsburgh during the 1960s civil rights era. So that was kind of like her first bout of activism. And she ultimately, her first claim to fame, or I guess you can call it her claim to fame, but her first first novel that she wrote was called Your Blues Ain't Like Mine. And to be honest, I have heard of that book, right? I've never read it, but I've heard of the book called Your Blues Ain't Like Mine. It was actually published in 1989, and it was Bebe's first critically acclaimed novel. The novel actually chronicles the lives of several characters that are affected by racially motivated crime. And there's lots of like complex character development and vivid storytelling, where she addresses the issues of racial prejudice, violence, and lasting effects of trauma. Now, Bebe Moore went on to write several books, some of which you might know. One is called What You Owe Me, which talks about the themes of being a Black entrepreneur. Brothers and Sisters, which dives into the complexities of sibling relationships in Black households. Singing in the Comeback Choir is one that is also critically acclaimed and is likely her most renowned work based on the research that I've done. That particular book is when she started to direct her or focus her work on exploring mental illness. And it recalls the story of a woman named Lily who is battling bipolar disorder. She also wrote the book Sweet Summer, Growing Up With and Without My Dad. She wrote the book I Get So Hungry. And the one that stuck out to me, which has now been added to my cart that's way too full of books, but you can't really have enough books, right? But the book that I found out that she wrote is called 72 Hour Hold. She wrote this in 2005, just a year before her death. With this particular book, she starts to explore the effects on families when it comes to somebody in the family struggling with a mental illness. She also brings up the idea of conservatorship. And so some of you guys might have heard of conservatorship when it comes to people like people in the media, like Kanye West or Britney Spears. I knew a little bit about conservatorship, but it is far more complex in terms of the different types of conservatorships than I realized. And this book talks about kind of like the back and forth emotions that come with trying to help a loved one help themselves while battling a mental illness, and ultimately having to decide whether or not you're going to pursue a conservatorship and then what that process actually looks like. So based on the based on the clips and in the quotes and the summaries that I've read, I can't wait to dive into this book. It's something that sounds super interesting, but I wanted to give you guys a little bit of background around what a conservatorship is. And I believe the novel is based in California, which I think is where she grew up. So in California, a probate conservatorship is a court proceeding in which the probate court appoints a responsible adult to manage the person's personal and or financial affairs of an adult who lacks the capacity to adequately manage these areas of their life on their own. The conservatorship process is initiated by a petitioner filing with the court the probate conservatorship forms for California. Now, in the book, she talks specifically about an LPS conservatorship. So LPS stands for Lanterman Petras Short Conservatorship. And these are reserved for adults with serious mental illness, such as bipolar disorder or schizophrenia or perhaps chronic substance abuse issues, and they show that they are at risk of harming themselves or harming others. So this particular type of conservatorship, an LPS conservatorship, can not only help protect the conservatee's rights, but can enable mental health professionals to administer treatment to that person without obtaining their consent. And I think that's where it kind of becomes somewhat controversial, I think, especially when we hear it in like mainstream, because typically it's tied to a person that we, maybe from a public persona or public perception, like Kanye West or Britney Spears, think that, oh, why is this happening? Maybe we don't know all the details. An example of an LPS conservatorship is if an adult is experiencing prolonged or serious psychotic episode that's causing them to neglect their hygiene, neglect their nutrition, their well-being, their children's well-being, or causing them to be a threat to other people, their psychiatrist can file the petition for the LPS conservatorship with the county's public guardian. So the LPS conservatorships don't fall under the umbrella of probate conservatorships, which are established to protect incapacitated adults. This is specifically for people who are battling with a mental illness. And I know I said mental illness or substance abuse issues, but addiction is also considered a mental illness in the DSM-5. 72-hour hold. Overall, it's talking about the ups and downs of a loved one struggling with mental illness, and it has a lot of sociopolitical commentary and a heavy emphasis on like what are some of the mental health disparities that are happening in society. So if you're like me and you like to learn about mental health, clearly you're here. So welcome to the club. This is another great way to learn about some of the emotions and the experiences that come with those types of struggles. So what else did BB do? She became a spokesperson for NAMI. And so NAMI is the National Alliance on Mental Illness. Eventually she became the founder of the NAMI Urban Los Angeles chapter. It's an organization that serves predominantly Black and Latino communities, and it created a safe space to talk about mental health. She provided support, education, and advocacy to her community. This is like a great example of somebody who was in one career and decided to kind of dive into the world of mental health and started to be a change maker within that particular field by doing what she's really good at, which is writing and telling stories. And so I think there's lots of ways to change the world of mental health and the field of mental health. And I'd love that this is an example of somebody who did it in a way that is still using their talent, but are able to create a significant impact, not just for their community, but ultimately when you're a spokesperson for NAMI, like you're impacting the country as a whole. In 2008, Congress formally recognized B.B. Moore Campbell with the B.B. Moore Campbell National Minority Mental Health Awareness Month. And so the sole purpose of that was to bring awareness to underrepresented groups struggling with mental illness in the states. That happened in 2008, which was 2 years after she passed after a short battle with brain cancer. She was married to Tico Frederick Campbell, an author and architect, and she leaves behind her daughter, Maia Campbell, who's actually an actress, a singer, and a model, and she is best known for her role as Tiffany Warren in the NBC UPN sitcom In the House. I believe she was on there for 5 seasons. She was also in Poetic Justice. Some of y'all might remember her starring alongside Tupac and Janet Jackson. And she was also in Beverly Hills, 90210. I believe she was also on Iyanla Van Zandt's show a while back. I want to say 2012. But she has also had her struggles with mental illness and drug addiction. And I wanted to just kind of make, it's an interesting connection, right? Because she wrote these, Beebe wrote these books that were talking about these experiences. And then the more I learned about her, the more I realized she was infusing a lot of her own experiences and some of her daughter's experiences into those books. So another way of uniquely sharing her story in a way that is relatable and also educational and allows us to be more empathetic when it comes to, you know, either whether it's dealing with family members or trying to help your coworker or your friend or help yourself when dealing with mental illness. So I have, man, that was, I think those two people are really interesting. I really want to bring you guys some more, a couple more of these episodes this month. So fingers crossed, I'm going to do my best, trying to not to bite off too much more than I can chew this month. However, I really hope that you enjoyed this episode. I have a bunch of sources for today. So as usual, y'all are going to find them in the description. But I hope that you found this helpful, and I hope that you're inspired by these people that have left these permanent marks and have permanently influenced the world of mental health for the better. If you are like, Ashley, there's some other people that, you know, you should think about, like, shoot me an email, slide into my DMs. I'm curious. I have like a list of, I don't know, 10 other people that I want to talk about. Will I get to all 10? I don't know. Maybe at some point. But if I, if you have somebody that you're like, hey, I am in school, or maybe you're just a nerd like me and you nerd out on mental health and you think this person has had a big mark on mental health, send them to me, because I will, in complete honesty, y'all, it has been a little tough finding Black people that have impacted mental health. Not because we haven't, but just because it is like, I'm digging through the interwebs for this information. So if y'all want to help me out a little bit, I'd appreciate it. But I hope, like I said, I hope you enjoyed this episode. It was short and sweet, a little shorter than a typical episode, but I hope y'all liked it, and stay tuned for the next episode. Y'all have a wonderful day, and don't forget to think about the 5 things that you are thankful for. All right, I'll catch you on the next episode. Bye. Thank you so much for listening to another episode of Black Girls Have Anxiety Too. No matter where you are in the world, I really appreciate your support. See you again on the next episode, but until then, follow us on Instagram at Black Girls Have Anxiety Too and on Twitter at Anxious Black Girls. That's Anxious BLK Girls. And remember, just because you're struggling doesn't mean you have to struggle in silence. The more we talk about it, the more we heal.